Bob settles into the chair. Not 5 minutes later, headlights rise like twin moons in the west. Bob sinks to one knee. As the vehicle draws near, he lifts the shotgun, ready to send a load of buckshot through the windshield. An old pickup, Ford with an over-the-cab camper, drives past and off into the night. Bob sits again. These false alarms are going to kill him. Bull sprawls on his bed, a plastic bag filled with ice pressed to his forehead. Fuck the fucking Rovers for dragging him into their shit. The fight they're waiting for could wreck this joint, and the few bucks he's made off them won't be compensation for that. He's been thinking about moving to the Keys, and tonight's convinced him he should. He's got enough money stashed to buy property there. Another motel, a legit one this time. Of course, in Florida, there's always the danger of running into someone holding a grudge. But plastic surgeons can work miracles, and if he lost some weight, his own mother wouldn't recognize him. Outside, Bob stands and stretches. He's never been able to sit for long, couldn't even make it through a movie when he was a kid without getting up 2 or 3 times. He leaves the cover of the Tamarisk carrying only his pistol and walks out to the road. There's not a car in sight. He thinks about what he'll do if Jesse doesn't show up tonight. If the fiends couldn't find the guy in Phoenix, they won't find him here. It might be time for him to go out on his own. He won't have anyone watching his back, but he also won't have to follow Antonia's orders or worry about anybody but himself. He'll be able to put all his time and energy into tracking down and dusting Jesse before Jesse finds and dusts him. He stands on the dotted line in the center of the road and lights a cigarette, takes in the glow of Vegas on the horizon. Gravel crunching in the parking lot snaps his head around. It's Jesse, toting a shotgun, creeping up on the cabins. "He's here!" Bob shouts and fires his pistol. Jesse turns the shotgun on him. He drops to the ground, but enough pellets get him that his knees won't work. He drags himself out of the road using only his arms. Real deal Antonia and Elijah fling open their doors. They spot Jesse and cut loose with their guns. Jesse sends a blast Antonio and Elijah's way, then charges Real Deal, firing at him on the run. Bull, cowering on the floor of his cabin, decides, "Fuck this," and flees out the back door. Someone shooting from the old trailer hits him in the leg. He howls in pain and falls hard. He's still howling when another bullet destroys his heart. Real Deal dives sideways in time to avoid too much damage from Jesse's hail of buckshot. With a joyous roar, he leaps on him when he barrels into the cabin, and they go down in a snarl of arms and legs, falling into the narrow space between the bed and the wall, Jesse's shotgun sandwiched between them. Real Deal wrenches one hand free and throttles Jesse.
"Yuma," he shouts. "You watching this, baby?"
Jesse comes up with a pistol from somewhere. Real Deal grabs for it, and the round ends up in the ceiling. He forces Jesse's arm down, Jesse fighting the whole way. His other hand is still on Jesse's throat, but he's having trouble choking him and controlling the gun at the same time. Jesse pulls the pistol's trigger again. This time, the bullet burrows into Real Deal's leg until it hits bone. He gulps the scream that wells up, but can't stop his hand from going to the wound. Jesse pushes him aside and scrabbles to his feet, headed for the back door. Real Deal grabs the shotgun he left behind and uses it as a crutch to lift himself. The pain in his leg is intense, but he manages to raise the shotgun. Jesse turns in the doorway before he can pull the trigger and fires the pistol at him. One of the rounds nicks his collarbone, and the arm holding the barrel of the shotgun goes numb, fouling his aim. Jesse's out back by then and out of bullets. Real Deal reaches the doorway and sees him toss the pistol and pull a knife. Real Deal roars again and brings the shotgun up one-handed, propping it on his hip. Before he can shoot, a bullet fired from the trailer gets him in the chest. As his mouth fills with blood, he recalls a cloud shaped like a duck that he saw when he was a kid. He drops the shotgun and falls to his knees. Antonia and Elijah open up through their back door on whoever's shooting from inside the trailer, then turn their guns on Jesse when he takes hold of Real Deal and drags him into the walkway between two of the cabins. "Cover me," Elijah says to Antonia. "Stay here. I'm going after him." No gunfire comes from the trailer as he runs to the walkway, but he's too late. Real Deal's been dusted, and there's no sign of Jesse. Elijah moves up the walkway, keeping his shoulder against the cabin to his right and his pistol up. "Where the hell's Bob?" he wonders. "Are you okay?" Antonia shouts. He's about to respond when something tears into his right leg above his boot. Looking down, he sees a knife buried in his calf. In the same instant, Jesse reaches out from the crawl space under the cabin, takes hold of the ankle of his other leg, and pulls hard, toppling him. Elijah rolls onto his back and points his pistol, but Jesse wrenches it out of his hand and turns it on him. One round hits him in the stomach. Two others miss. He cringes, anticipating another shot. But Jesse has a new target. It's Bob, shotgun in one hand, pistol in the other, who's appeared at the front end of the walkway. Bob cuts loose with the pistol, and Jesse returns fire with Elijah's gun, then turns and flees to the back of the cabins. He runs smack into Antonia, who's come looking for Elijah. They fire at the same time. Antonia's shot misses, but Jesse's gets her in the face, the bullet entering under her right cheekbone, exiting over her left ear, and knocking her off her feet. Elijah screams her name as she hits the ground. Jesse snatches up the shotgun real deal dropped and makes for the ruined trailer at the back of the property. Bob dashes out of the walkway, chasing him and already in his mind catching him and twisting off his head with his bare hands. Jesse whips around and fires the shotgun. The blast tears away Bob's shirt and most of the skin from his chest to his thigh on his left side, exposing red muscle, yellow fat, and white bone. Tough as he is, he almost faints. A man's not meant to see that much of his insides. He falls behind Real Deal's Harley as Jesse disappears into the trailer. Elijah staggers from between the cabins, grabs Antonia, and pulls her back into the walkway. He wipes some of the blood off her face. Her bulging right eye settles into its socket, and the hole in her cheek is closing, but she's still unconscious. The sound of the shots fades, and smoke drifts away. A fraught calm falls over the battlefield. Bob's wound is healing, but still hurts like a motherfucker. He reloads his pistol to take his mind off the pain and retrieves the shotgun he dropped when he was hit. When he's back behind the bike, he hisses loudly, a signal. Elijah pokes his head around the cabin. "Real deal," Bob mouths. Elijah picks up a fistful of sand and lets it sift through his fingers. "Antonia." Elijah wobbles the same hand. "So-so." Shotgun and pistol fire pour from the trailer, lighting up the night. Bullets and buckshot ping off Real Deal's Harley and chew up the cabin behind it. Bob curls into a ball. When the salvo dies down, he realizes he's been hit in the foot. Blood pours out of a rip in his boot. The guns roar again, the target this time Elijah's ride. Sparks fly, bullets ricochet, and the bike topples over. Bob sits up when the shooting stops. He'll be damned if he's going to cower like a frightened rabbit until he's picked off. Hissing again to get Elijah's attention, he throws him the pistol and aims the shotgun over the seat of Real Deal's Harley. "Hit him!" he shouts, and he and Elijah blast the trailer until their guns are empty. A moan from the trailer breaks the silence that follows. Bob drops behind the bike, pulls some shells from his pocket, and reloads. It's time to end this bullshit standoff, and he's the one who'll have to do it. He calls out to Jesse. "I hear you," Jesse replies. "Do you surrender? That's not how this is going to go. You're outnumbered and we've got better position. We'll either make you use up all your ammo and rush you or keep you pinned until morning and let the sun take care of you." "Or you might talk me to death," Jesse says. "What if I give you a chance to better your odds?" "Why would you do that?" "This is really just between you and me. You dusted my partner and I killed your girl." "Go on." Bob checks the shotgun wound. It's almost healed. "Give my people time to ride out of here, and I'll let whoever you've got with you leave too," he says. "Then you and me'll go toe-to-toe with knives. Finish what we started on the mountain. You'll have a 50-50 shot." In the walkway between the cabins, Antonia has healed enough that she can sit. She and Elijah listen to the negotiation and wonder what Bob's up to. It seems like a needless gamble. "You take a bullet to the head, too," Antonia says. "Hurry and make up your mind," Bob shouts at Jesse. "This is a limited-time offer." "Your people go first," Jesse says. "Fine," Bob says. "I'm going to get up and go talk to them. Talk to them from where you are." Bob rolls over so he's facing the cabins. "You hear all that?" he says. "That's not how I'd play it," Antonia says. "Well, that's how I'm playing it." "You expect us to just ride off and leave you," Elijah says. "Go on and don't look back," Bob says. "The fiends are through. It's every man for himself now." Elijah looks at Antonia, eyes asking if he should try harder. "Sounds like he's got his mind made up," she says. She's seen the end coming for a long time, but hadn't pictured this. Elijah helps her stand. "We need to get our things," she calls out. "Leave it," Jesse says, "and your guns, too. We're supposed to trust you. If you're going, go now." Elijah tosses the pistol, and he and Antonia step out into the open, hands in the air. They walk past Bob, crouched behind Real Deal's ruined bike. Good luck to you, Elijah says. See you down the road, Bob replies. They sit on Antonia's Harley. She starts it, and they ride slowly around to the front of the motel. Bob hears the engine clatter as they set off and thinks, good riddance. Your turn, he shouts to Jesse. The black man from Beaumont's limps out of the trailer with a blood-soaked rag tied around one of his legs. He walks between two cabins toward the road. When he's gone, Bob says, I'm getting up now. The shotgun wound hardly hurts at all when he stands, and his foot's okay, too. He keeps his gun pointed at the ground. Jesse appears in the doorway of the trailer, carrying a pistol and a knife. Drop the iron, he says to Bob. You too. Jesse flings his pistol into the scrub. Bob does the same with the shotgun. As the men advance toward each other, Bob frees his knife from its sheath on his belt. They stop 10 paces apart. One, Bob says, going into a crouch. He's grinning. Can't wait to cut this motherfucker to pieces. Two, Jesse twists his feet to plant them in the dirt. Three, Bob rushes Jesse, going hard, but Jesse sidesteps and jabs with his knife. He misses and has to spin around. Facing each other, the men shuffle sideways, circling. Bob waves his empty hand, and when Jesse glances at it, lunges, slashes him across the chest, and skips out of reach. This is his plan. Get in, strike, get out. If he keeps it up, Jesse'll soon be so weak he won't be able to dodge. They go back to circling. Bob faints a few times, but Jesse doesn't take the bait again. Instead, he speeds up, shuffling faster and faster, forcing Bob to speed up too. Ha! Jesse shouts like he's steering a mule. Ha! When he stops suddenly and reverses direction, Bob trips, trying to mirror him. Jesse's on him in an instant, stabbing and pulling away before he can strike back. The pain's not bad enough to bring him down, but he tastes blood, and every breath is a struggle. He's got to keep circling, though, keep his eyes on Jesse. The fucker knows he's hurt and isn't going to give him time to heal. Sure enough, he moves in again, knife raised for an overhand strike. Instead of trying to get out of the way, Bob shifts just enough so the blade sinks into the fleshy part of his shoulder instead of his chest. He then grabs Jesse's wrist with his free hand to stop him from pulling the knife out, and at the same time stabs him in the back. Jesse lets go of his knife, jerks his arm free, and stumbles backward. Now both of them are hurt too badly to keep circling. They glare at each other as Bob pulls Jesse's knife from his shoulder and tosses it aside. Bob means to say something smart but can't speak, so spits instead. In 10 seconds, he'll go in for the kill. 10 seconds of healing. 9, 8, 7. He almost groans out loud when Jesse reaches into his jacket and pulls out an ice pick. The fucker is putting up more of a fight than he expected. 4, 3. Jesse walks toward him but stops out of striking range. Bob waves his blade, and Jesse watches it like it's a swaying snake, and he's calculating when to reach out and grab it. Bob lunges and jabs to foil any attack the man might be cooking up, and Jesse backs up a step. Bob lunges again, and again Jesse retreats. The third time Bob tries the move, Jesse deflects his strike with a sweep of his arm and counters with a jab of his own. The tip of the ice pick barely pricks Bob's chest, but the sting is enough to flood him with fresh anger. Strategizing on the fly, he pretends to fumble his knife, drops it, and bends to pick it up. Jesse falls for the ruse, rushing in with the pick aimed low, meaning to get him in the throat. Bob stops him in mid-thrust by grabbing his forearm, snatches up his knife with his other hand, and stabs upward toward Jesse's chest. The bastard clamps onto his wrist, though, before the blade finds its mark. They wind up face to face, chest to chest, Bob clutching Jesse's right arm, Jesse hanging on for dear life to his. A slapstick tango ensues as they try to knee each other in the balls, spinning round and round until their legs tangle and they topple over. Bob lands on the shoulder Jesse stabbed, and a bolt of pain nearly blacks him out. By the time the static clears, Jesse's got the ice pick between his ribs and is probing for his heart. Bob realizes his knife is still in his hand and thrusts it into Jesse's belly. The last thing he hears before his body finally gives out is Jesse's scream. When he comes to, who knows how long later, Jesse is face down and out cold beside him. His head whirls when he sits up, but there's no time to waste. He grabs his knife and rolls Jesse onto his back, straddles the son of a bitch, and lays the blade against his neck. He's 2 strokes into dusting him when Jesse's eyes pop open. The ice pick, Bob thinks. Too late. Jesse shoves the pick up through the bottom of his chin, through his mouth, and into... Chapter 29. Jesse uses the ice pick embedded in the fiend's head to guide the body to the ground. The wound in his stomach makes him feel like he's drunk acid, and he lies back and waits to heal more. When the worst has passed, he dusts the biker with the biker's own knife. He still doesn't feel safe, though, not with the last two fiends in the wind. He gathers all the guns he can find and carries them to the truck in a bindle made from a bedsheet, taking it slow, watching the road, and listening for a motorcycle. When he gets close to the pickup, he pauses to look for signs of trouble. Everything seems to be fine. Sanders is even behind the wheel. Jesse wasn't sure he'd make it back. He was lying in a puddle of blood when Jesse ran into the trailer, not moving. Assuming he was dead, Jesse went to the window and watched the big, dark fiend he'd stabbed drag the blonde woman he shot to safety. Sanders groaned, startling Jesse.
"Where you hit?" Jesse asked.
"My leg," Sanders said.
A bullet had passed through his thigh. Jesse cut a sleeve off Sanders' shirt and tied it around the leg. It was no kind of fix, but it would get him through the next few minutes when Jesse would need him. He groaned again as Jesse hauled him to his feet, but the leg supported his weight. Jesse had him take up a position at the window, and he crouched in the doorway. After striking the deal with the fiend who killed Johanna, allowing Sanders to go, he told Sanders,
"Wait in the truck. If I'm not back by dawn, take off."
"And your brother?" Sanders asked. There was only one alternative.
"Put him down," Jesse replied.
Edgar not being able to fend for himself, it'd be a mercy killing. Jesse waves at Sanders now as he approaches the truck, says,
"You alive?"
"Barely,"
Sanders says. Jesse walks back to the camper. Edgar peers down from a bed in a nook above the cab.
"Monsieur Beaumont went crazy," he says. "He like to have kicked that box to kindling."
"Come up front," Jesse says. "Everything's settled."
Sanders keeps drifting in and out of consciousness, so Jesse drives. Edgar rides between them. Nobody says anything on the way back to Vegas, not even Edgar. Instead of gassing about cartoons or begging to turn on the radio, he stares out the windshield, his big knuckly hands clutching the dash. Jesse and Sanders reek of blood, gunpowder, and exhaustion. Jesse opens all the vents, flooding the cab with fresh air. Sanders needs help walking to the room. Jesse lays him on the bed and strips off his trousers to examine his leg more closely. Through and through, as he thought. One hole in the front of the thigh, one in the back, both barely bleeding now. He's in a lot of pain, and Jesse feels that patching him up is part of their bargain. He goes through the man's first aid kit, but he'll need more than what's there to do the job right. Edgar's on his bed, watching television. He doesn't look over when Jesse starts making himself presentable enough to go out.
"You want a hamburger?" Jesse asks him.
"Two Big Macs," Edgar says, "and French fries."
"What about you?" Jesse says to Sanders.
"I'm fine."
Jesse walks to an all-night drugstore for peroxide and gauze, and buys a few extra burgers from the McDonald's next door in case Sanders changes his mind. Sanders, lying in the bathtub, hisses when Jesse pours peroxide into the bullet holes and bloody froth boils out. By the time Jesse bandages the leg and gets the man back to his bed, Edgar is asleep. Sanders nibbles at a hamburger and is soon sleeping too. Jesse stretches out on the floor with a pillow. It's the first chance he's had to relax in 2 days. But rest doesn't come easy. Whenever he closes his eyes, a vicious montage unspools. Him stabbed and shot, and stabbing and shooting. Guns and knives and blood. Rovers collapsing into dust. He and the fiends fight on the mountain. He and the biker fight at the motel. And Johanna dies over and over. It's light outside before exhaustion finally shuts him down. The first thing he hears when he wakes is laughter. The television. Edgar's watching from bed, and Sanders is writing to his wife. The sun is down. He can feel it. He stands and stretches. Besides being parched, he's doing okay. He drinks 3 glasses of water and takes a long shower, keeping his mind on the night ahead and not letting it stray into sorrow. He tells Edgar to pack his things and is surprised when he fills his grip without kicking. He walks to the nearest casino and cases the parking lot. Spotting an old Galaxy 500, he sidles up and jams a screwdriver into the door lock. A few taps with a hammer, a hard twist, and he's in the driver's seat. After a bit of work on the ignition cylinder, he touches the starter wire to the battery wires, and the car comes to life. All Edgar's got to say when he walks back into the room is that he's hungry again. "We'll get something on the way," Jesse tells him, and sets about packing his own suitcase. It doesn't take long. The shirt and jeans he's wearing are the only clothes he's got not covered in blood. He takes Sanders's .45 from the bundle of guns and lays it on the table.
You might need this, he says to Sanders. Sanders doesn't respond. He looks even more miserable than usual, like he could either cry on someone's shoulder or kill them, depending on the direction of the next breeze. Jesse's felt the same way 1,000 times, but doesn't have any sympathy to spare. He's running along his own tightrope, keeping moving to keep from falling. He stashes his knife in his jacket, picks up the guns and his grip, and takes one last look around to make sure Edgar hasn't forgotten anything he'll be whining about an hour down the road. Then it's a quick goodbye to Sanders, and he and Edgar are out the door. Edgar's got the mully grubs, too. Hasn't said 3 words all night. Jesse points him to the galaxy and puts their grips and guns in the back seat. They're going to Seattle. He's tired of the heat, wants to see mountains, smell trees.
What about Disneyland?
Edgar says.
We'll go soon, Jesse says.
Edgar snickers.
You're a liar and the truth ain't in you, he says.
They stop at A&W for supper. Edgar tells the car hop she's pretty and asks for his own tray. The girl brings one out and hangs it from his window. The food livens him up. He guzzles his root beer, burps, and licks at the foam on his upper lip. He's messing with his fries in a way Jesse scolded him for in the past, rolling each in ketchup, dirtying his fingers before popping it into his mouth. Jesse ignores it this time. He'll never forgive him for what he said about Johanna, but he also can't see riding him too hard after what he's been through. A Little League game is in its 5th inning on a baseball diamond next to the drive-in. A kid hits a fly into left field, the thwack of the bat on the ball not reaching Jesse's ears until the boy's already running for first. The fielder gapes at the sky and punches his glove. The ball goes to him like it was meant to, seeming to slow almost to stopping as it drops into his mitt.
I'm gonna get me a motorcycle, Edgar says.
No, you're not, Jesse says.
I'm gonna ride with the fiends. They're tougher than you.
You sure about that?
I seen them fight.
So how come they're all dead and I'm still here? Edgar drops a fry into his puddle of ketchup and flips it with the tip of his finger.
I'll start my own gang then, he says.
What'll you call it?
The Pirates?
Jesse goes to piss before they hit the road. The car is running when he gets back, Edgar behind the wheel.
What the fuck are you doing? Jesse says. Touch the one wire to the two, Edgar says. I remember.
You don't mess with the car without my permission, you know that.
Can I have permission to drive?
Get back on your side. Edgar acts like it takes everything in him to slide across the seat. They head north. Jesse figures they can make it to Wells or even Jackpot before having to stop for daylight. An hour into the drive, Edgar, who's been sulking, turns on the radio. Jesse shuts it off.
Please, sir, may I play the radio, sir? Edgar says.
His resentment at having to ask is obvious, even behind the funny voice he uses.
You may, Jesse says, rewarding him for following the rules.
Traffic is sparse on the highway. When they meet another vehicle, it's usually a big rig, some as festooned with colored lights as Christmas trees. Hank Williams's I'm So Lonesome comes on the radio. After the first verse about the whippoorwill being too blue to fly and the moon hiding behind a cloud to cry, Jesse changes the station. The only way he'll get through the next few nights is to keep one step ahead of grief. The galaxy blows a tire an hour past Ely. Jesse manhandles the car to the shoulder, kills the engine, and lucks out when he finds a flashlight in the glove box. His luck continues when he pops the trunk with his screwdriver, and there's a jack and a spare. Give me a hand, he calls to Edgar, still in the car. It's the left rear tire that failed. Edgar holds the light while Jesse loosens the nuts with a lug wrench and jacks up the car. Jesse's sweating as he pulls off the ruined tire and slips on the spare, has to dry his hands on his pant legs before replacing and finger-snugging the nuts. Edgar can't stand still. The flashlight beam keeps jumping around. Quit fidgeting, Jesse snaps. He lowers the car, tightens the nuts, and carries the jack to the trunk. The engine starts, and he slams the trunk shut, and through the rear window, sees Edgar in the driver's seat again.
God damn it, he yells.
Edgar puts the car in reverse and hits the gas. The back bumper shatters Jesse's left knee. He falls to the ground, and the galaxy crushes his right ankle as it rolls on top of him. The car stops then, but Jesse's stomach is against the muffler. The hot steel sears his flesh. That's what finally starts him screaming. He's still screaming when Edgar shifts into drive and takes off. His shirt catches on the bumper, and he's dragged out into the road before the fabric tears and he skids to a stop. The galaxy speeds away, its taillights visible long after the sound of the engine has faded.
Chapter 30.
The little devil starts in as soon as Jesse springs me from the camper after he and Mr. Sanders come back from the Red Arrow Motel. "He don't care nothing about you," he says. "He killed Abby. He tried to kill you. You can't trust him." He keeps spitting poison until I fall asleep in Mr. Sanders' room. Ruins my hamburgers, ruins my French fries. I wake up thinking about Abby. When I recall what happened to her, I feel like crying. I feel like taking a knife to Jesse and dusting him. "Do it," the little devil whispers. I turn on the Brady Bunch to drown him out. Mr. Sanders is writing in his book. He says, "Do you have to play it so loud? He'd best watch himself, or I'll off him, too." Soon as Jesse gets up, he tells me to pack my bag. We're moving on. Stacking the little I have left in my grip steams me even more. There's my cards, but I want my checkers. There's my dinosaurs, but I want my sword. We're going to Seattle. They got Brakeman Bill there and J.P. Patches and Gertrude. The new car Jesse stole is a galaxy. A galaxy is stars you need a telescope to see. I looked at the moon with a telescope. There's a face on it. Sometimes the moon's out during the day. What you call a Judas moon. Judas betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Jesse betrayed me for a piece of ass. A&W ain't gonna make up for that. Every time I look at Jesse, I get mad all over again. He goes to pee and I slide over and start the car. "Drive off," the little devil says. "Get away!" Jesse comes back before I make up my mind. He yells at me in front of the waitress girl. When we get going, he makes me ask permission to turn on the radio. I do, but ain't ever gonna again. The little devil keeps talking over the music about revenge. The car swerves and Jesse says it's a blowout. He tells me to come help him change the tire. I want to tell him to fuck himself, but I'm scared. I remember him choking me. I remember fighting to breathe and not getting air and fighting to breathe and almost swallowing my tongue and fighting to breathe and forgetting how. I'm shaking such I can't hold the flashlight still. Jesse yells at me and the little devil's yelling too. "If a dog bites once, he'll bite twice," he says. "Carefully, don't brain you with that wrench." I can't think straight with all the noise in my head. When Jesse goes to put the jack in the trunk, I walk up and get in the driver's seat. That's when the little devil takes over. It's him who touches the one wire to the two to spark the engine. It's him who puts the galaxy in R and gives it gas. It's him who runs Jesse over and drives off. "Don't look back," he says. "Keep your eyes on the road." I don't think about nothing but driving. I ain't never done it alone before. You gotta do all the concentrating yourself. You gotta steer and work the gas and watch what's coming all at the same time. The little devil goes back in his hole. Got nothing more to say. I stop at the first motel I come to. Jesse's wallet's in the glove box and there's money in it. The lights are out in the motel office. I knock on the door and ring the bell. A Chinaman answers, grumbling about it's late. I tell him I had a flat tire. He comes back with a key and says there's no hot water in the room, but it's the only one he's got on account of there's a highway crew staying there. I say cold water will be fine. The room's on the second floor. I get my grip and Jesse's out of the car and carry them up. I take the guns, too. The room smells sour, and there's a bug in the sink. The television goes on, but no channels come in. I get my cards out and deal two hands for crazy eights. It's no fun playing myself. I open Jesse's grip and look through it. His shaving kit, the photo book, and them sunglasses Jehona give him. I hear him telling me to leave his gear be. I hear me saying, "Why? You ain't got nothing anybody'd want to steal." I stick his wallet in one pocket and one of the pistols in the other and go out on the walkway. The parking lot is full of pickup trucks. Past them is the highway and a truck stop all lit up on the other side. Alamo, it's called. Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier, got killed at the Alamo. I draw the pistol and point it at the gas pumps. You close one eye to aim. Pow. I pretend this time, but if Jesse finds me, I'll shoot him for real. I'll practice till I can knock a bean can off a fence post till I can hit a silver dollar throat in the air, because I'm sure he'll dust me if he gets a chance. He ain't never believed me about the little devil. I cross to the truck stop. They got every kind of potato chips in the store there, every kind of candy, every kind of soda pop. There's hula girls for your dashboard fishing poles and tackle and Wile E. Coyote belt buckles. They even got CB radios. I pick one up and ask how much. The cash register man says, $75 plus tax. Does it work? I say, we wouldn't be selling it if it didn't, he says. Jesse's wallet is fat with $20 bills. I hand the man four to make 80. He gives me back one and some change. There's slot machines by the bathroom.
Star-spangled sevens. I hand the cash register man another $20 bill and ask for quarters. He gives me a paper-wrapped roll and $10 back. I sit at the game and tap it three times. Three times for three sevens. It don't work. I drop coins and pull. Drop coins and pull, but the damn thing doesn't hit. The cash register man comes over smoking a cigarette. Mind if I watch, he says. I tell him there ain't much to see, but he's welcome. I only got two quarters left when three bars come up and some coins jingle into the tray. The cash register man says, I'd quit while you're ahead, and I say, I guess you're right, and stuff the quarters in my pocket. I take my CB into the diner and sit at the counter. The waitress lady is as old and fat as Mama, but's got yellow hair. She calls me handsome when she brings the menu. How are you, handsome? I tell her to give me hot cakes, sausage, and scrambled eggs, and orange juice. A big glass, not a little one. I ask if they got blueberry syrup. Better places got blueberry syrup. Nope, sorry, she says, only maple, but it's just as sweet. She asks me, you with the road crew? No, ma'am, I say, passing through. I set my quarters on the counter and stack them four high. Four makes a dollar, and I got $4.50 worth. I ask the waitress what time the sun comes up. About 5:30, she says. What time is it now, I ask. She looks at her watch. 5:05, she says. I shovel my food in and get back to the room when it's coming light. I gotta be more careful. I hang the Do Not Disturb sign on the doorknob. I make sure the curtains is shut. There's cartoons on now. Gigantor on one channel, Bugs Bunny on the other. I put on Bugs, but don't pay attention, because I'm worried. It's day, so if Jesse ain't here, he ain't coming. Could be he ain't even looking for me. Could be he's dusted. I wanted that when I was mad, but I ain't so mad anymore. He ain't been all bad. I know how to do some things, but not all of it. I ain't never hunted. I ain't never killed. Jesse always took care of that. The dark where I see things comes. This time all it is blackness, blackness, and me crying, crying and saying no. When it lifts, I'm shaking like a goose walked across my grave. Where am I gonna go? What am I gonna do? The only one I gotta talk to is the little devil, and all he does when I ask is belch. I feel like if I don't do something good, I'll do something bad. I take my CB radio out of the box and set it on the bed. I turn the knobs and nothing happens. It's got a book of how to work it, but the letters are too small and the pictures don't make sense. I pick up the microphone and press the button. Breaker, breaker, this here's the wolf man, I say. Come back, good buddy. I press the button again. This here goes out to Jesse, I say. I know it was your mama's favorite. And then I sing. Oh, let me die in winter when the night hangs dark above. And cold the snow is lying on bosoms that we love. Ah, may the wind at midnight that bloweth from the sea chant mildly, softly, sweetly, a requiem for me.
Chapter 31. July 5th, 1976, Las Vegas. Continued. I came to hearing Jesse asking where I'd been shot. He used my shirt to bandage a wound in my thigh. We'd been pinned down by the bikers, but Jesse wasn't about to give up. He propped me at the window with the .45 and wedged himself in the doorway with a shotgun, and we proceeded to turn two of the fiend's Harleys into scrap metal. We were about to blast the last one when the bikers opened up on us. Knowing the walls of the trailer wouldn't stop anything, I dropped to the ground. The pain in my leg was so bad, I thought I'd been hit again. When the shooting petered out, I struggled to find some way to sit that didn't hurt. The fiends must have been in bad shape too, because the next thing I knew, Jesse and one of them were going back and forth, negotiating safe passage for the other bikers and myself. I was too dazed to feel much relief about leaving, and worried I wouldn't have the strength to get back to the truck. A motorcycle carrying a pair of fiends drove off, and then it was my turn to go. Jesse said, if he wasn't at the truck by dawn, I should leave without him. In that case, I asked, what about Edgar? He quickly and coldly told me I should kill him. My God, I thought, this truly must be hell. I was dealt another blow seconds later. As I prepared to leave the trailer, I warned Jesse not to forget about the fat man I'd shot. Said he must be close to healed by now. He won't be healing, Jesse said. I asked what he meant. He's not a rover. Hoping he was mistaken, I made a beeline for the body as soon as I limped out of the trailer. There the man lay, wide-eyed, open-mouthed, and dead. 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 And I was confronted with the awful fact that I'd killed a human being. I'm not sure how I kept going after that. Some instinct for self-preservation kicked in and powered me out to the highway. Every step was agony, and my existence narrowed to the task of keeping moving. Prayer helped, but my plea got simpler and simpler until in the end it was just, "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus," repeated over and over. I hardly recall reaching the truck, Jesse's return, or the ride to the motel. The trek had done me in. I truly believe I was straddling life and death seemed like the better option. Jesse dressed my wound properly, and a long, dreamless sleep followed. My leg still hurt when I came to, but I could sit up without feeling like puking, and I managed to hobble to the bathroom on my own. The sun set while I've been writing this. Edgar's watching television, and Jesse is stirring on the floor. I killed a man, helping him get his revenge, and was almost killed myself. So I hope he keeps his promise to let me go. I'll say a prayer now for the soul of the dead man, and another begging forgiveness for his murder. I doubt they'll earn me any grace, but maybe they'll get me through the night. July 7th, 1976, outside Truckee, California. Czarnecki's cabin is the last place I thought I'd find myself, but here I am. In a way, I guess, it's appropriate. This nightmare will end where it began. To backtrack a bit, Jesse was a man of his word. The night after the shootout at the trailer, he returned my wallet and Czarnecki's 45, and he and Edgar drove off in a stolen car. My first thought was that I should leave the motel too, put some distance between me and the scene of my crime, but my leg still ached, and I needed more rest. My appetite was back, so I had a pizza delivered. After eating my fill, I thought of Beaumont, chained in the camper. He'd been without food or water for nearly 24 hours. He didn't say anything when I lifted the lid of the crate, didn't reach for the jug of water I offered him. "I won't beg you," I said. "I need to use the toilet," he said. I told him to go on. He stood slowly, awkwardly, chains jingling. I turned away while he squatted over the bucket. "May I stand for a bit?" he said when he finished. I let him lean against the counter while he ate a couple of slices of pizza and drank some water. "Where is Jesse?" he asked. "Gone," I replied. "But I'm still a prisoner." "For as long as you earn your keep," I said. "You're going to help me hunt rovers." "Well, living in a box and shitting in a bucket. Better than you'll do in hell. I'd rule hell in a week." I took his arrogance as a warning. After being surprised by Sally, I'd never again let my guard down around a rover. But I'd have to be extra cautious with Beaumont. I could tell from his sneer, from the tilt of his head, that even in chains he thought he was superior to me and would always be scheming to escape. The first chance he got, when I was feeding him my own blood to keep him alive, he'd be on me like a tiger. I hurried him into the crate and didn't feel safe until he was locked inside. Back in the room, I changed the dressing on my leg. It didn't look any better, but it also didn't look any worse. I tried to get lost in a ball game on TV. But you know how that goes. Whatever's bedeviling you always wins out. That I killed a man, even mistakenly, weighed heavily on me. Rovers were soulless demons, and with not much twisting, I could convince myself that putting them down was doing the Lord's work. Killing a human being, though? Even if the man I shot was a killer himself, murder is a mortal sin. And then there was the matter of the future. If I continued down the road I was on, I'd be hunting rovers in earnest, carrying on Czarnecki's crusade a crusade that had always felt more like a curse. Driving around night after night with a monster beside me searching for other monsters, then becoming a monster myself in order to put a bullet into the brain of what was once a man, to stick a knife into the heart of what was once a woman, to saw the head off of what was once a child. Doomed to darkness, doomed to danger, doomed to death. I couldn't think of anything else but to put it in God's hands. They say Jesus prayed so hard the night before he was crucified, he sweated blood. I don't know if that's true, but at 4 a.m., after hours of beseeching the Lord for forgiveness, for direction, for a sign he was even listening, my leg started to bleed again, a red rose blooming on the bandage. And at the same moment, I heard a voice in my head, a voice saying, "All debts are paid." I've been a prayerful man all my life, a questioner, a petitioner, but I've never experienced anything like that. I don't know if it was God speaking to me or through me. I don't know if the debt was to Benny or to God or to the dead man, but I do know this. I received permission from someone I needed permission from to change course, to abandon the brutal path I'd found myself on. I slept a few hours. My mind was clear and quiet when I woke, and the rock that had filled my gut ever since I learned of Benny's death was gone. I decided to leave immediately. There was one final horror to be lived through, though. Beaumont, knowing it was day, was uneasy when I opened the crate. He tried to sit up, but I pushed him back. "Don't do it, brother," he said. "I've lived too long and suffered too much to have it end like this." "I'll pray for you," I said. "Unchain me, and we'll pray together," he said. "That's what God wants, brother. Listen to God." I stuck an ice pick in his chest. His eyes widened. His heels drummed on the wood of the crate. But then he stilled. I used a hacksaw to take off his head, and he collapsed into dust, a king no more. I loaded my things into the truck and drove north, arriving here at Czarnecki's cabin around 4. I mean to be gone before dark, which isn't far off now. I only came back to get the Econoline and cover my tracks some. I sank the .45, the murder weapon, in the first lake I came to, and scrubbed everything here that might have my fingerprints on it with a bleach-soaked towel. Doorknobs, the dishes I ate off, the lock on the shed, even the shovel I used to bury the old man. I wiped down the camper and truck too, cleaned the shoe polish off the van, and burned the posters of Benny and my scrapbook. When the work was done, I ate a can of tuna and took a nap. And I've spent the last hour writing this, the final entry in this journal, which started as a chronicle of my search for Benny's murderer and ended up a killer's confession. Afterward, I'll burn it too, because there's no reason for you to read it, no reason you should be burdened with such awful knowledge. When the pages have turned to ash, I'll drive to Reno, check into a nice hotel and eat the biggest steak I can find. And then I'm going to call you. I'm going to call and tell you I've finally accepted that I'm never going to find the person who killed our son. And I'm going to ask if I can come home. If you say yes, I'll be in San Diego before you know it. I'll wrap my arms around you and hang on for dear life as I thank you for taking me back. I'll start teaching again. I'll go to dinner at Chewy's with you on Saturdays and to church with you every Sunday. And the only thing I ask is that if I ever wake up screaming, you forgive me when I don't tell you what the dream was. And if some night we're out and you catch me staring at someone and I suddenly grab your hand and say, "Let's go," you don't ask why. You just come along quickly and quietly. Hopefully, that won't happen too often. Hopefully, with the Lord's help, I'll become very good at forgetting. Today's passage. Remember ye not the former things, neither consider the things of old. Behold, I will do a new thing. Now shall it spring forth. Shall ye not know it? I will even make a way in the wilderness, and rivers in the desert. Isaiah chapter 43, verse 18 and 19.
Chapter 32. Elijah squints at Antonia's Italian phrasebook, runs his finger down the page. He can barely see the words in the dim light of the church, but finally finds what he wants to say. "O fame," he whispers into Antonia's ear. She's staring at a statue of Mary cradling Jesus, a mother and her dead son. "One of the most famous sculptures in the world by one of the most famous artists," she said. Elijah whispers again. "O fame." "What's that mean?" Antonia says. "I'm hungry." "Un momento." It's been 5 months since the shootout at the motel and the end of the fiend. In the aftermath, Antonia and Elijah threw away their leathers and dumped the Harley. Elijah shaved his beard and cut his hair. Antonia grew hers long and has taken to wearing embroidered Mexican dresses and turquoise jewelry. New identities, new beginnings. They've had a few. They took a night flight from New York to London and another to Rome, where they've been for a week. Every afternoon at 4:30, when the winter sun sets, they leave their hotel to visit sites on Antonia's list, and every one of them has been more beautiful than she imagined. Her knees shook in the Sistine Chapel. The Trevi Fountain made her dizzy. And now this, Michelangelo's Pietà. The marble figures are so lifelike she wouldn't be surprised to feel a pulse if she put her fingers to Mary's throat. Wouldn't be shocked if Jesus' flesh was warm to the touch. The sculpture is surrounded by bulletproof glass. A few years ago, a madman attacked it with a hammer, breaking off one of Mary's arms and her nose. Luke used a hammer when he went crazy, too. Went crazy and beat little Abigail to death. Went crazy and murdered wee James. She came home right after, had been to the grocer, was carrying a sack of onions and potatoes. Luke greeted her naked, bloody, raving. "Hello, wife, I've done for your piglets, and now I'll have you." Because she threatened to leave him, to take the children and go. She went crazy herself then, got hold of a kitchen knife and stabbed him 20 times. If she hadn't discovered that she had killing in her that day, that she could kill and not care, would things have been different? If she hadn't been shown that all men were beasts, would she have so readily become a rover, a beast of all beasts? She blinks away the question. She blinks away the past. Those babies died of the pox. Her eyes climb a column to the church's vaulted roof, to the dome hazy with scented smoke from an earlier mass. All the pain of her life has been worth it, if that's what it took to get here. To see the candles flickering like fireflies in front of the chapels. She and Elijah walk to the statue of St. Peter. Visitors, kissing rosaries and crossing themselves, are lined up to touch its foot. They join the queue. "You're not getting religion, are you?" Elijah says. "It's tradition," Antonia says. When it's her turn in front of the statue, she gazes at its toes, worn shiny and shapeless by the caresses of countless pilgrims seeking mercy. Fools, she thinks, before reaching out to stroke the foot herself. She and Elijah eat at a restaurant on a little square with a fountain. Their table is against a window fogged by the warmth of the room. Elijah uses the edge of his hand to clear a patch so they can watch people rushing past, bundled against the cold, their breath puffing and trailing like steam from locomotives. Christmas lights are everywhere, even though it's only a week into December. The waiter, with his droopy gray mustache, speaks enough English to guide them through the menu. Elijah orders spaghetti carbonara for the third time. Antonia frowns at his lack of imagination and asks about the specialty of the house. "Saltimbocca," the waiter says. "This means it will jump into your mouth." "I'll have that," Antonia says. She opens her guidebook. "The Colosseum is open late tomorrow," she says. "That's something we've got to see." "All right," Elijah says. "It's where gladiators fought. Sometimes it was man against man, and sometimes they fought lions and tigers and elephants. Elijah's staring out the window, watching a bum in a ragged coat stagger to the fountain and splash water on his face. Antonia sees the bum, too. "You're not that kind of hungry, are you?" she says. "Not yet," Elijah says. "Did you notice the camp by the river, those drunks? Are you telling me not to worry? There's plenty of good hunting." "I'd like to stay here a while, and then we'll go to Madrid. You can show me where you were born." "You're the one with the memory," Elijah says. "I've forgotten everything about the place." "You don't know what'll happen when you see it again," Antonia says. "It might all come back to you." She signals the waiter. "I believe I'll have wine after all. Do you want some?"
"Sure," Elijah says.
She smiles and opens her phrasebook to see how to say red. Chapter 33. Jesse hauls himself out of the road and into the scrub, his fear of being spotted worse than his pain. The effort exhausts him. He can't do anything afterward but stare up at the glittery web of stars spun across the sky. He should have anticipated trouble. Edgar's been getting more and more sneaky and defiant, and at the same time more strange. All his talk of visions and the little devil. If he hadn't been distracted by Johanna and the fiends, he'd have seen this coming. He let his guard down, and now he's paying the price. It's 3:30 by the time he can stand. 2 hours until sunrise. Wells, the nearest town, is an hour's drive. His best guess is Edgar will stop there. He'll need to get a ride soon if he's going to make it by dawn. He retrieves his denim jacket from where he tossed it while changing the tire and buttons it over his torn and bloody shirt. The guns are in the galaxy, but he's got his knife. He sets off along the shoulder. He's been walking 15 minutes when headlights finally appear. He steps into the road and waves his arms. A semi charges out of the darkness like a rhino. The driver sounds his horn but doesn't slow down. Jesse is nearly bowled over by the blast of hot wind as the truck passes. He fingers grit from the corner of his eye and keeps walking. 10 minutes later, another truck comes along from the opposite direction this time. Jesse crosses the highway. Again, the rig blows by like the driver didn't see him, as do two more that pass during the next half hour. Time is growing short to reach shelter before daybreak, and panic nibbles at Jesse's edges. More headlights. He stands in the road, waving madly. It's a car this time, a dusty gremlin. It slows and comes to a stop 20 feet away. "What's wrong?" a man calls out. "I had an accident," Jesse yells back. He reaches into his pocket for his knife as he hurries to the car. "Hold up," the driver says. "Keep your distance." Jesse ignores him and goes to his window, which he's desperately trying to roll up. He's an old man with thick glasses and buck teeth. An old woman cowers in the passenger seat, clutching a little old dog. Jesse grabs the edge of the window and stops it from going any higher. "I need a ride into Wells," he says. "Let go of the glass," the old man says, still trying to turn the handle. "I'm hurt," Jesse says. "Let go of the glass." Jesse yanks the door handle, but the door is locked. He reaches through the window for the knob. The woman screams, the dog barks, and the man stomps on the gas. Jesse is spun around when the gremlin takes off, twirls, and falls to the ground. The realization that it's too late to make it to Wells settles over him like a leaden shroud. He starts walking again. False dawn comes and goes. He keeps walking. Another truck barrels past. He doesn't try to flag it down. Just keeps walking. The sky is paling when he spies an abandoned homesteader cabin. He makes his way to the windowless, doorless shanty and sticks his head inside. It's not the sanctuary he was hoping for. The roof has collapsed, leaving only one corner of the interior covered, and there's no chance of cobbling a shelter out of the debris. Someone's burned it all in the center of the dirt floor. He scans the surrounding desert. Would a thick enough blanket of brush protect him from the sun? Might he dig a hole and cover himself with earth? He steps outside, drops to his knees, and begins scooping a temporary grave. But it's only a foot deep by the time the sun crests the hills to the east and sends a wave of orange fire rolling across the desert. He returns to the cabin and crouches under what's left of the roof. Can't do anything but watch helplessly as sunlight slides toward him, a deadly incoming tide. Closer and closer it creeps, until he's forced to stand with his back to the wall. The shadow of the remaining bit of roof holds back the brightness, but in an hour when the sun rises above the cabin, there'll be no escaping it. He charts the sun's ascent by the light descending the walls, his desperation increasing as one by one his benchmarks, the bent nail, the stain that looks like a 10-gallon hat,
The top of the F in the spray-painted fuck next to the window are illuminated. His anxiety peaks when the scrap of shadow beneath his feet starts to fade. His legs quake, his teeth chatter, and he wonders if he'll shake himself to pieces before the sun incinerates him. Then suddenly, mercifully, a great calm blooms in his chest. The wisest man he ever met was an old sailor who held down the end of the bar at the Whale, a low-down San Francisco saloon later destroyed in the quake. Snipe, as this sailor was known, would, for the price of a rum, answer questions about matters both practical and philosophic. Everything from what to do to unstick the lid of a pickle jar to how to woo a woman above your station. One night, as a lark, Claudine bought him a drink and told Jesse to ask him something. On the spot, Jesse struggled to come up with a question. Snipe noticed his difficulty and said, "I know what you want to know. You want to know what happens to you when you die." This was actually the furthest thing from Jesse's mind. He was a rover and didn't anticipate ever dying. But he humored the old man, telling him to go on. "When you die, what you believe will happen to you is exactly what will happen to you," Snipe said. "If you want angels, you'll get angels. If you think you're headed for hell, you'll end up there. And if you think this sad slog is all there is, it'll be all there is." Jesse scoffed at the words then, but remembering them now, he's filled with new courage. He moves from the shade into the sunlight and walks out the door of the cabin. His flesh smokes, and the pain is everything he feared. But he doesn't fear it anymore. After 20 feet, his body is dust, but the rest of him keeps going. The rest of him steps onto the road and heads down it. The rest of him watches a cloud drift, a jackrabbit run. The rest of him sniffs sage and kicks an empty can. The rest of him sees Claudine materialize out of a watery mirage and runs laughing to her.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Rovers, written by Richard Lang, read by Mark Vitor and Wayne Carr, produced by Jen Patton Sanchez, directed by Michelle Figueroa and Patrick Smith, post-production by Ibar Iden. Rovers is also available in print and as an ebook from Mulholland Books, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2021 by Richard Lang. Audio production copyright 2021, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.